You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, I have the honor of sitting down with John Moody. He is the interim director for Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. We are talking about an absolutely crucial issue today. We're talking about food freedom in a very broad sense, and what they do is they defend the rights and freedoms of family farms and consumers and their access to food, to raw milk, to nutrient-dense foods, to foods of their choice and their choosing. And it's very apt on their website, and it's very apt that we just celebrated the 4th of July, our independence from Britain. And one of the points of redress against the crown is, quote, "He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance." And I'm sitting here and I'm getting the chance to speak with John Moody, and he's going to tell his story and some of the things that are happening with regards to food freedom. That's the way I like to talk about it. And this is an absolutely crucial issue. If you do not have food sovereignty or food freedom, you don't have freedom at all. And quite frankly, the government has transitioned from one back in the World War II era, where they had the concept of the Victory Garden and, you know, every family keeping hens for eggs, to a point of total control, all in the name of safety. And John enlightens us in this area very much. It was a great pleasure to sit down with him. And so here we go. Well, hey, John, thanks for being with us and taking your time. I know you're extremely busy. And I'd like to start off today by just having you tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, and what brought you to this point in life.
Well, thank you very much for having me. You know, being here, if my family were to listen in, my family that I grew up with, my brother, sister, my dad, they would be amazed to see where I am. I grew up an inner city kid in Youngstown, Ohio. Basically had four food groups that I would eat, you know, like Cheerios, sugar, Fruity Pebbles. You know, I ate a very poor diet, was a very standard American kid. And I moved to Kentucky back in 2000 to do my master's work, and I was only in my early 20s, and I began to become really, really ill. And like most Americans, I always considered myself healthy, even though I had dental cavities, even though I had seasonal allergies, even though I broke so many bones, you'd think I was an MMA fighter. I was like, oh, I'm healthy, you know, American. We're like healthiest, greatest people in the world.
Whatever. Right.
And so when I was starting on my master's, I think it was in my second year, I developed a condition known as duodenal ulcers.
Okay.
Duodenal ulcers, real simple to explain. Take Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, shove them in your gastrointestinal tract, give them razor-sharp pickaxes, crack cocaine, and Metallica music.
Wow, yeah, that sounds pretty intense.
it's just like a little band of wandering gnomes are ripping you apart from the inside out.
Okay.
It's just unrelenting, ceaseless pain. So I go to my doctor, and, you know, my doctor looks at me, and he goes, hey, he goes, this isn't a super big deal. And I had a better doctor. Like, I had a doctor who already was thinking, like, we need to ratchet back antibiotic use. So while he was a mainstream doctor, he wasn't quick to throw drugs at you.
Okay.
And you know, he goes, this isn't a real big deal. He goes, we'll need to put you on this medication. And I'm like, well, what does this medication do? And he pulls out the drug insert. And it's almost like a moment out of one of the old Bugs Bunny-type cartoons where he pulls the insert out to read about it, and it opens, and it just keeps unfolding until it hits the floor. You know, and it's like this tiny little print that you need an electron microscope to read. And he goes, well, you know, he goes, this drug shuts off your body's ability to produce hydrochloric acid. And my first thought was, I'm a superhero. like Batman has nothing on me. Like, I can produce hydrochloric acid inside of my body. That stuff, so many people try and steal in high school to do pranks with or get, like my body produces that. And then my second thought was just like, if my body produces hydrochloric acid, isn't that important? Like, if it's something my body produces, that can't be the problem.
Right.
Something else must be the problem, and you're going to give me a drug that merely covers up not the problem. And when I said that to my doctor, he didn't really have a good – he didn't have any good way to respond. You could tell, like, he never thought about medicine that way.
Right.
It just wasn't in his mental configuration to think, oh, like, I'm treating a symptom of a problem rather than identifying and healing the problem. But I was in such bad shape at the time, I had no choice but to go on the medication. But I had a professor at the school I was attending who a few months earlier, probably 5 or 6, I'd had lunch with this professor, and I'd asked him a pretty simple question, going, you know, like, what's the most important thing you've learned as a father over the past 5, 10 years, whatever? And when I asked him that question, he looked at me, and he gave a most intriguing answer. He basically shared how he had started to have some significant health issues, and he and his wife had retooled how they thought about food, how they sourced food, how they prepared food.
Got it.
And that had really significantly cleared up some health issues in him and his family's life. But then he said to me, you know, he's like, you know, you're single, and you're in math, you know, you're doing a master's. He goes, when you find a girl, you know, give us a call when you can pursue these things a little more profitably, and we'll talk with you and stuff. So I just kind of tucked that away.
Right.
And at this point, when I got sick, I think, you know, I don't think my wife and I were engaged at that point, but we had been seeing each other for probably 6 months or a year. So I had a girl, and we were, you know, I think we were about to get engaged if we weren't engaged. We might have been engaged by this point. And so we called up Dr. Guthrie, and, you know, he put us on the phone with his wife, and we just asked her a whole bunch of questions. And she recommended some basic starting resources. And for the next 6 months, I just read and read and read books on cooking and books on, you know, nutrition. And, you know, Sue Gregg's work led to Sally Fallon's Nourishing Traditions, and Nourishing Traditions led to reading Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. And I went to an Acres conference, and it was just this long spiral, or this long, like, unpeeling of the onion.
Right.
You keep just ripping one layer after another. And at the same time, on a practical level, Jessica and I would sit down every week, and we would choose what are 2 changes we're going to make this week to our lifestyle and our eating and stuff. Whether it's, oh, this week we're going to learn to make a whole chicken in a crock pot and make bone stock or whatever.
Right.
Or we're going to learn to make our own cleaners this week. Or we're going to switch from synthetic store-bought chemical-laden deodorant to a natural deodorant, one we make at home, or a deodorant stone. And so, you know, over 6 months, we were making multiple small incremental changes that when you look back after 6 months, you're just like, our life is totally different.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like it was a completely different world. And at the end of 6 months, I had completely healed my duodenal ulcers.
Wow, that's awesome.
Which my doctor, because when I went in and he put me on Nexium, he said, oh, he goes, you know, you're probably going to be on this medication off and on the rest of your life. And I had it for that one stretch, and I've never gone back.
That is awesome. Hey, John, let me interrupt you real quick. because you got my juices flowing. I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. What would you say was the number one resource that influenced you in your 6-month journey as far as education? I'm sure it's been ongoing, but can you point to like the most important resource that you read? And then also, what was, looking back on that initial block of changes, what was the single biggest change? Even though it's small and incremental, what would you say? What would you offer?
Oh, well, in terms of the book that was probably the most practically influential, it was Sally Fallon's Nourishing Traditions.
Okay, very good.
So just because, like, her book, for a person like me, her book was a nice nexus point in the sense of, like, you go into her book looking for answers about nutrition, health, and food, but she forces you, I shouldn't say force isn't the right word, the book invites you, though, to see the larger panorama of how food is raised, how food is prepared, how food is processed. And then lifestyle and other things.
Got it. It makes a lot of sense.
And so, like, while that book may not have, like, what some would consider the best or most up-to-date information, it was very accessible and extremely helpful to my wife and I. You know, there's a joke that, like, people who buy that book, guys tend to read the sidebars and women tend to read the recipes.
Okay.
The way the book is laid out,
right?
There's a recipe on every page, but then there's a left or right hand column, and that always contains some interesting snippet,
yes,
information that invites you to go further and read and explore more for people who are, you know, just wired that way. So that book was the most significant one. And then in terms of the biggest change, it was just the commitment to steadily replacing synthetic, modern, processed foods with real foods.
Got it. Okay.
And so that change took many forms, whether it was getting our first grain mill or, I ate so much box cereal as a child that probably 3 or 4 acres of the Amazon being deforested is my fault.
Okay.
I mean, like, I would eat a box of cereal a day if given an opportunity.
Got it. Yeah.
You know, and so just systematically looking at how we were eating, what we were eating, and moving each item one by one over to both far more affordable, but also way more nourishing and health-promoting real food alternatives.
Yeah. That was a great answer. I'm sorry to derail you a little bit there. And so please continue on as your journey through to health and all of that.
So I regained most of my health. You know, I had seasonal allergies so bad growing up that Benadryl offered me free stock options.
Gotcha.
and over that couple-year period, when we first began to reform and rethink and reformulate diets, nutrition, health, lifestyle, I got rid of my seasonal allergies, along with my duodenal ulcers and any dental decay.
Awesome.
It was just amazing. I'm healthier in my late 20s and early 30s. Than I was in my early 20s and late teens.
Right.
Which doesn't make sense to those people because they generally think, oh, your college years, that's your most healthy years, blah, blah, blah. And then it's just all downhill from there.
Yeah, the reality is that those are the years that you're most able to handle the most amount of toxins most of the time.
Your body is at a point where, sadly, it's the most forgiving of the stupidity of our modern educational, nutritional, lifestyle choices.
Right. So your mantra is probably let thy food be thy medicine and let thy medicine be thy food.
Yeah, as much as possible.
Right.
I really love Dr. Tom Cowan's work just in the sense of like somebody who seeks to balance the different medical disciplines that are available, whether it's herbalism, or chiropractic and some modern medicine things. You know, I always have a joke with people where it's just like, if I get ran over by a car and you hand me an herbal supplement, I'm going to beat you silly.
Right.
I want a doctor if I've been ran over by a car.
Sure.
You know, so it's just, it's realizing there's proper roles and places for these different healing modalities, especially if we understand what they can and cannot do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always tell people, like our medical system, our doctors are the best in the world at patching you up if you get into a car wreck. But as far as disease prevention, let's look somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really it. It's just like, if you have a broken bone or a compound fracture or a, you know, arterial cut or something, you want one of our modern doctors.
But yes.
If you're struggling with, you know, chronic infections or tooth decay or allergies, you want a farmer.
That's right. very good.
So, yeah. So, you know, so at this point, my wife and I are now married. And we've gone from shopping at, like, Walmart and Sam's Club to shopping at Whole Paycheck and Wild Oats before they got bought out by Whole Foods. And, you know, I have a background in economics and mathematics before I did my master's. And, you know, I was looking at the pricing at Whole Foods, and I was just like, man, I was like, this stuff is so expensive. There's so much organic junk food here. And then I began to look at the economics for the farmers. I'm just like, you know, I'm paying $9 a pound for boneless, skinless chicken breast from a farmer I don't even know, from a state I've never even been to. And the farmer's getting like $1?
Yeah.
I'm like, what? I'm like, how does that work? And so my wife has a cousin in Iowa who did what she called like a food buying club. You know, where they got their milk from a local farm and they all kind of organized together to order food from a company in one big order to save on cost. Because my wife and I were like super, super poor when we first got married.
Right. I can agree. I can definitely hear you on that.
Yeah. You know, like I was finishing up a master's. You know, she was pregnant basically, you know. Yeah, in the first month or two of marriage, she ended up being pregnant, which was wonderful. We had two kids in our first 3 years of marriage. you know, it's just like, it's the typical story that was normal for most of human history, but makes modern parents, because of, you know, the whole socioeconomic implications, unhappy.
Right.
You know, so like, we're wanting to buy real food, but real food in, you know, the grocery store channels is both not all that real and it's really expensive.
Yes.
And we're adding kids far quicker at that time than I'm adding income.
Right.
and so my wife's like, hey, why don't we start a food buying club? And to leave out a number of deals, it basically, we did eventually start a food buying club. I was originally supposed to go do a PhD in Canada, and we decided for various reasons that wasn't going to happen.
What was your master's work in?
I did my master's in at Southern Seminary.
Okay.
So I have a really strange educational background. I started college as a science major, chemistry and biology. I spent a year as a mathematics major, and I finished with a finance and economics degree.
Okay.
And then mathematics minor, and then I went to seminary to study to be a pastor.
Gotcha.
So I did Greek and Hebrew and history and theology. And then post-seminary, I did 2 or 3 years of classics in ancient Near Eastern history.
Okay.
So I did Latin and all these other things and spent a month or so touring Turkey and Greece and all this other crazy stuff. And then I got into food and farming.
Gotcha.
so I have an educational background that makes absolutely no sense. So when people look and they're like, how did you get from like here to there? And it all makes good sense to my wife and I. But to somebody who just met us, they're just like, this is crazy.
Yeah, I know. I've got a couple of master's degrees, but I tell people all the time that I would trade those two master's degrees for some well-honed carpentry skills anytime and some farming skills.
Yeah, and it really is, you know, especially with just the way our economy is going and other factors.
Yeah.
You know, like we could conceivably next year easily grow all of our family's own vegetables for the year and supply a large majority of our own meat.
Excellent.
Which means, like, if we need, you know, if I lose a job, if I just need a break from job, if I get sick or injured, you know, there's a security there that the Bible talks about, you know, being able to provide for your own, labor with your own hands.
Absolutely.
So that's, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, you know, I'll just share with you real quick our, you know, we're working really hard out here, and we're trying to do the same thing. And our goal for 2016, summer of 2016, is to be able to provide 80% of our caloric intake from our own land. You know, averaged out over a week's time. You know, throughout the year. Right now, we're about 25 to 35% there, so I'm pretty happy with where we are, and we're getting better, a little bit better all the time.
Yeah, well, and that's what it's been for us, you know, it's just like improving our health, you know. So we started a food buying club with some other families. It's now one of the largest food buying clubs in the nation. So, and we serve hundreds of families around Louisville, Kentucky. And our food buying club was actually raided by the Kentucky Health Department.
Yes, yes.
And you know, people who are listening in, if you want more details on that, you can Google, you know, Whole Life Buying Club, you know, raided by Health Department. It'll bring up some of the stories from that time or some of the other interviews I've done on the subject. And what made our situation unique was, up until that point, there had been probably 5 or 6 different government raids on alternative, locally oriented food distribution systems across the country. The more notable one is like the Rossum raids in California.
Yep, remember that.
There's the Athens locally grown one where they made them pour out the milk. They got caught on video. There was the Manna Storehouse up in Ohio, where they held that poor family at, like, SWAT team point.
Yes, I remember that one as well.
Which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
and, you know, listeners can go get a copy. You can stream it on, like, Amazon or Netflix or wherever, of the movie Farmageddon by my friend Kristen Canty.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
It's a wonderful movie.
Yes, it is.
First-hand interviews with all these different people, and a lot of first-hand footage of the authorities shaking them down.
Yeah. So yeah. Your stand was pretty incredible. I watched a presentation you gave about it, and can you share a little bit of that with us here?
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, before I proposed to my wife, we were out to dinner somewhere. And I looked at her, and I said to Jessica, I go, just so you know, I go, probably at some point during our marriage, I'm going to go to jail. I know people just crack up when they hear that, because it's like, you know, you're dating somebody. Is this really, like, how you woo and romance somebody? You know, but I'm just like, you know, I value honesty. I wanted to be very upfront. You know, I just saw the direction some things were heading in our culture and nation, I don't tolerate bullies like that. Like, I'm just not willing to sit back, be bullied, you know, or let other people be bullied. And so I said, hey, you know, one day I might go to jail.
Yeah.
and so the health department came, and they served our buying club with cease and desist and quarantine orders. And kind of to shorten up that story, I think I gave that presentation at the Weston A. Price Regional Conference. So it's probably up on our Farm to Consumer Facebook page. Probably has a copy of the video. And you know, basically, after some thought and some prayer and consulting with a few people, you know, I contacted all of our members – And I basically explained to them, like, we have a God-given constitutional right to choose what we eat and who we get it from.
Absolutely.
Like, this is a non-negotiable line in the sand kind of moment.
Right.
And I just said, like, I am willing to go to jail to preserve that ability for my family and my community. Because if you're not going to draw the line there, there's just nowhere left to draw the line.
Right, right. It's a principled stand, and especially today in today's culture, if you're going to make a principled stand, especially upon biblical grounds, you're going to have some battles, and obviously you did.
And so I read through sections of the Kentucky Constitution, and I copied and pasted the sections I felt were most pertinent. We printed those off, and we hung those right next to the cease and desist order, and we made a place next. We printed another sheet that said, you know, I, the undersigned below, in accord with the rights granted to me by the Kentucky Constitution, am taking my food. I'm taking my personal property. And if the Kentucky Health Department wants to talk with me about this, they can contact me at the phone number below.
Cool.
Because part of the thing is, too, it's just like, I love chess. I love strategy. And one reason Rossum, Mana Storehouse, other groups were such easy picking is it's very easy for the bureaucracies to chew up and spit out single individuals.
Yes.
Because it just doesn't cost that much. It costs some money, but for them, in a battle of attrition, spending $250,000 on one principled person isn't that much money to get all the rest of the sheep to stay in the paddock.
Absolutely. Great point.
But when they start looking at the economics, and also the public sentiment fallout.
Right.
Well, what are you going to do when there's 100 families? What are you going to do when there's 150 families? What are you going to do if 1,000 families say no?
Right. No, that's great.
Yeah, and so I wanted to create a situation where, like, you know, my members, my wife knew I was willing to go to jail, even though I would look terrible in stripes, and even worse in bright orange. But I wanted to create a situation where the health department would have to come after a large number of people or no one at all. Yeah. I wanted to make it a really, like, you know, if they won, it was a Pyrrhic victory in every possible way.
Right.
Where they would have just so many, you know, so many negatives, they'd suffer so much in trying to win that they would lose even if they were able to stop our buying club.
Right, right.
So we did that. Members and people from all over Kentucky came and signed that piece of paper. Members who never drank milk signed that piece of paper. People who weren't even in our buying club came and took milk and signed the piece of paper. Just to let the health department know, this is, you know, this is a place we will all stand together against you.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time, we engaged in a few other things. I reached out to a lot of media to make sure it got into the media what was happening. We also were handed a gift because our health department did it over Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that.
Yeah, and so, you know, another big thing when you're going through these battles is you need to take advantage of the opportunities you're given, because this is a holiday where everybody is supposedly celebrating how our forebears died horrible deaths in ridiculous wars to secure for us freedom.
Right.
And me and these hundreds of families in Kentucky are being denied even the most basic freedom of choosing what we eat and who we get it from.
Yes, and when you place it like that, it just sounds utterly ridiculous.
Oh, exactly. And so that's another big thing I did with my members is as they called their elected officials on Memorial Day, on Monday, you know, it's like, be very kind, be very respectful, but when they ask you, why the heck are you bothering them on a holiday, make it clear to them, like, you would be celebrating, save the fact that the Kentucky Health Department is taking away the freedoms your family members died for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I have a friend who's worked in Kentucky politics for a long time, and I saw him at an event 4 or 5 months later. And he looked at me and he said, I guess it was just that week following when the health department served us those orders and stuff. I guess it was a terrible week for them.
Great.
where, you know, because they just, they're, you know, like, they're getting calls from every elected official, they're getting calls from hundreds of angry people, and they're getting phone calls from council. You know, it was just, it was marvelous. It played out excellently well.
All right.
And the health department by the end of that week sent us a letter basically saying, like, this was a misunderstanding. We don't have jurisdiction over this area. You know, we're getting clarification from so-and-so. And ever since then, they've left us alone.
Excellent. Okay, so they backed off. And then overall, as far as you know, specifically Kentucky and then more generally the United States, from your perspective, have the laws become more favorable or more tyrannical regarding food choice?
Oh, it's a total pitched battle at the moment where it, you know, the deck of the ship goes back and forth.
Gotcha.
You know, on one hand, some states like Wyoming, where farm-to-consumer member Frank Wallace is, they just adopted the first food freedom legislation in the country. And Maine, where farm-to-consumer member Heather Rettberg is, I think they now have 15 or 16 towns who have adopted the Food Sovereignty Declaration.
Okay.
And we could do a whole show on that because that it would be great. I don't know if you can have two people on at once. It would be wonderful to have Heather on at the same time, and me and her could talk at the same time with people about the amazing things they have done in Maine.
That would be awesome. Yeah, I would love that because I'm very passionate about this subject. I've been waiting to talk to you for a long time, so that would be great.
Yeah, and so Heather would be a great person to have on with us. You know, so they have 15 or 16 townships, counties, municipalities that when the Maine government, and even sadly a Republican government with a Republican attorney general, when the Republicans denied the people of Maine the ability for their communities to feed themselves, and yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that you're saying it's a pitched battle across the board, across the nation, and I see that too. There's wins and losses. There's places where it's becoming more tyrannical. There's places where it's opening up, but at the same time, there's backdoor regulations coming into play. You know, what from your perspective, what are the major problems overall regarding our nation's food system?
Oh man.
I know that's
like a 6 hour. You know, I mean, like, the problems with our food system, you know, it would make the novel War and Peace look like a short, brief bathroom read.
I know. You can pick or two.
Well, I mean, it's just like it's so systemic. You have, if I were to summarize what is the main problem with our food system, it is the USDA.
Yeah, the USDA, like, as Joel said.
Yeah, because everything in our modern food system flows out of the FDA and the USDA. Like, you know, so the centralization.
Yeah.
The totally the totally insane pricing where carrots are more expensive than Coca-Cola.
Right.
But, like, all of that is driven by the legacy of Earl Butz and what he did, I think it was in the 50s and 60s.
Is that where he said, go big or go home?
Yeah, it's get big or get out.
Yeah.
Or go big or go home. I'm sure he probably used both.
Yeah.
The knucklehead that he was.
Yeah.
you have these governmental policies enacted at a national level. You have that Supreme Court decision with that grain farmer where he was growing food just for his own animals on his own farm, and a federal judge ruled. I mean, it's one of the worst precedents in all of court history. Though, I mean, you know, over the past 30 years, we've been working hard to get more stupid precedents.
Right.
Really tied down into our legal system. But that one, especially in terms of food, was just devastating. Where growing food in your own backyard to feed to your own animals is considered interstate commerce and subject to the Commerce Clause.
I don't even know how you even remotely come up with that. I mean,
and the judge said because by him growing it in his backyard, he's no longer buying it, which means he's affecting the interstate market.
Oh, wow.
It's tortured. Right. I mean, you know, the founding fathers, you know, they would not roll over in their graves if they could. They would come out of the grave.
Right.
I mean, like, when you have judges making those kinds of decisions and claims, it is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, the centralization, the no longer accurate pricing schemas of food, the penalty, and just so much of it is this top-down governmental regulatory structure that just harms and harms and harms our food system.
Yeah. So, yeah, for sure. I mean, you're right. We could go on and on and on. How about just real quick, you know, the nutrient density of the food? I know you're kind of deep into the subject as far as, you know, personal consumption. Nutrient density of the food in our commercial system has just, I mean, it's just plummeted. I mean, this is a huge problem.
Yeah, I give a talk. I gave it at the Paleo FX conference, and it's called Dirt Poor. It's called Dirt Poor, Badly Bred, and Improperly Prepared.
Gotcha. Okay.
And I chronicle, you know, basically, most of our modern food is it's like anywhere from 30 to 70% less nutritious than 40 to 60 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Think about that. Think about, like, it's unreal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I don't even know how to begin to explain to people, you know, and why we tolerate a food system that... Yeah,
you know, and it's interesting because when you look at, you know, you look at all these studies, and I don't want to go too deep in the studies, but as production goes up, as these producers figure out ways to bump up production, it's like there's a corresponding decrease in nutrition. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, the worst part is, though, it doesn't really have to be that way.
Right.
Because, there are farming methodologies that allow you to increase production and increase nutrient density and the healthfulness of what you're doing. But that requires a non-monoculture-based approach.
Right.
You know, you have to adopt a completely different view of ecosystems and interrelationships and economics to make that happen.
Right. Now, you guys have a polycultural system on your farm. Now, do you put any stock, or have you done any work with as far as remineralization of your soil?
Oh yeah. I mean, in a given year, I'm dropping weight wise on my farm probably easily 50 tons of material to rehabilitate and build soil and nutritive value.
Nice. Okay.
So any source of wood chips I can get my hands on, I'll actually be going to Louisville tomorrow, and when I go, I'll be picking up about 2,000 pounds of coffee grounds.
Nice.
That I'll be bringing back. Unless you are a very lucky person, there are very few pieces of property out there that do not require, soil's a bank account.
Yeah.
What would happen if you, like, every cucumber you harvest, every berry you pick, every blade of grass a cow eats is a check that you're writing against that bank account.
Right.
And so, just like your bank, if you don't make deposits and you're always cutting checks, you eventually get in trouble.
Right. You just described our modern commercial system.
Oh, yeah.
We keep writing checks.
Yeah. Well, and so it's just like, you have to make deposits. And in a perfect world, we wouldn't be getting our deposits from the ocean and from the mountains. Because even a lot of organic farmers, they're remineralizing heavily by, we're using kelp and we're using
rock dust and...
Yeah. And so, like, these are fossil fuel, long-distance intensive inputs that are also highly suspect in terms of if something goes wrong with the distribution supply chain. So there's actually just an awesome article on the phosphorus crisis we're going to be facing over the next 10 to 20 years in agriculture, because we're running out of phosphorus to be used, in these growing systems. We're using phosphorus and we're not getting it back.
Okay.
And these are finite resources, it's just like with oil or other things. I'm not a peak oil guy. I'm not a global warming guy per se, but at the same time, like, the world has limits.
Right.
And these resources have limits. And so, like, if we use up all of the phosphorus deposits that are relatively easy to find, and you develop growing methodologies that are completely dependent upon these things, what are you going to do?
Right, right. You're setting up a system that's set up for failure.
Yeah. This is why I love Joel Salatin when he says, he doesn't believe in global warming, but he definitely believes in curtailing fossil fuel use.
Right.
Because, it's a limited quantity resource.
Yeah, and we're called to be wise stewards of the resources that we have, and, why would we use it up as fast as possible?
Yeah. So it's just lots of interesting things. So we started this buying club. We were rated by the state. We won. A year or so after that, I was invited to become one of the board members for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I was a board member for a number of years, and then this past fall, they asked me to step down as a board member and become the organization's first executive director. And so that's now the role that I serve in.
Okay. Now, what does that entail?
Oh, it's interesting. I wish I could give an easy answer to what it entails. It's a highly complex, multifaceted extravaganza.
Gotcha.
it's everything from, talking with members like Heather Retberg and being an encouragement to them, seeing how we can help them with their grassroots efforts in the states they're working, speaking at conferences, speaking at other events about food farming and food freedom and food sovereignty, talking with legislators and politicians, it's all the different sorts of things that being in charge of helping run a major organization entails that works nationally on a very difficult and highly complex set of policy issues.
Absolutely. It sounds very demanding and very challenging for sure. What would you say are I know we could probably talk about this for 6 or 7 hours, but what are some of the biggest battles that you face as far as Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund?
I'm trying to think what would be the best ones. You know, it's always changing.
Right.
At the national level, the Food Safety Modernization Act is the worst. As that continues to be rolled out in the negative ramifications for yet another federal bill that does the opposite thing of its name.
Yeah, don't you love the Orwellian nature of all of our bills?
Oh, it's really quite frustrating. Sense of like, because it was predicted. Like, Orwell foresaw this, and he did many things to, try and warn us, and he was highly unsuccessful.
Yeah.
so at the federal level, the continued presence of subsidies and other things coupled with the insanity of the Food Safety Modernization and other similar acts are at the federal level our biggest challenges.
Okay, gotcha. All right.
At the state level, it just varies so greatly.
Yeah, you guys seem like, when I look at your website, it says defending the rights and broadening the freedoms of family farms and protecting consumer access to raw milk and nutrient-dense foods. Do you guys have a particular emphasis with raw milk?
Well, that's how Farm to Consumer got started.
Okay.
Sally Fallon, who's the head of Weston A. Price, a lot of farmers, about 12 or 13 years ago, large numbers of raw milk farmers in the nation were being actively accosted by the food police.
Right.
And she was like, well, these farmers need some legal protection. So she gave the seed money that allowed Farm to Consumer to start. So when Farm to Consumer started, the majority of our cases involved raw milk.
Okay.
Now that raw milk has become more normalized, it's very similar to how concealed carry has gone.
Right.
We still have raw milk cases. More so what we do with raw milk now is help people with their legal and other arrangements in their various states. Since in some states you can do leases, in some states you can do herd shares, in some states you can do pet milk. So we help people navigate that really complex maze from state to state, depending on where they are and what they want to do. But we actually just rolled out, it's going to go up on the website soon. We've had a lot of people who really aren't farmers, they're homesteaders.
Right.
And so we've introduced a homesteader membership category.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So it's brand new. The board just approved it at one of our recent board meetings, where for people whose primary goal is more to feed themselves than vocationally farm, we rolled out a homesteader membership, and we're hoping to, maybe later this year, but it might be early next year, we're also going to be releasing a first-of-its-kind resource called the Small Farm and Homestead Legal Handbook.
Okay.
And we're going to release two of them, and these resources are geared for helping small farmers and homesteaders have a good grasp on all the different legal issues that are going to come up over your life of being a homesteader or farmer, whether it's property line and fence line issues or water rights issues,
yes,
or overspray and pesticide risk issues, or handing off the farm issues, bequeathment and taxes and estate planning. So there'll be two great resources for both member types, or what are the on-farm processing rules and cottage food law. So these books will give our members, and then they'll also be for sale to the general public, they'll be a great one-of-a-kind resource to help these tens of thousands of people who are trying to go back to the land, better navigate the complex legal hurdles and mazes that they don't always realize they're getting into.
That is awesome, because it is definitely complex. And that's, you know, that's, those are some of the things that we're struggling with right now, is figuring out processing, you know, laws, you know, as far as exceptions and small herd exemptions and cost shares, and can we process on our own property and then sell, you know, and can we do more than 1,000 birds a year, you know, et cetera. All these things, it's so difficult to, because you got to look at all the state laws and you got to look at the federal laws and navigate.
That's why, you know, this is why we encourage people to become a member of Farm to Consumer, because, you know, we're also going to start this fall doing a weekly webinar call-in on different subjects for members.
Well, great.
But at any time, if you're a member and you're not sure about the laws in your state, if you're a member, we have a 1-800 number you can call and talk with an attorney.
Excellent. Well, I'll tell you, I have been meaning to become a member, and I will. I promise you that. It's just I've been procrastinating, but that's ending really soon.
Well, and you know, it's the sad part is we get a lot of people when they finally get in trouble, and then we're not always able to help them.
Yeah.
Because it's the old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Absolutely. You're right.
And so it helps us a lot when we get people who are members, and as you're going through making decisions, you get a chance to get some input on those as you're structuring agreements or arrangements or thinking about your options in a particular state. We can do a lot more to help people and keep you from making a costly mistake on the front end.
Yeah, that's great stuff.
Which then minimizes the need on the back end for some of the less enjoyable things that we've seen happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great idea. And you know, we're longtime members of HSLDA when we were still homeschooling and all of that. And,
yep.
And you know, it is important. It's very important. So, you know, I'm looking forward to becoming a member and getting into the weeds and having that support in the back pocket in case we need it.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, it's sad that I need to be a member of Farm to Consumer. It's sad that you need organizations like HSLDA,
right,
and Heritage Defense, in a supposedly free country.
Right.
So, you know, like...
And it's sad that there has to be a law that's made that allows me to sell raw milk or process a chicken or anything else.
Oh, yes, exactly. and so, like, I would love, you know, I would consider my life a success if one day we no longer needed Farm to Consumer. Sadly, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I don't see that happening either.
But that is our, you know, that is my personal goal. I would love to work myself out of the job by securing freedom for people to grow their food and to access who they get food from.
Yeah. You know, oftentimes I talk with people, and it's always interesting to me when I look at history and you look at the World War II era, whether it's in the UK or the US, when you had the concept of the victory garden, you had the concept of the small flock for every family, and in the UK it was everybody should grow rabbits, you know, to help, you know, reduce pressure on the system, and they wanted self-sufficiency, they wanted resiliency in the families back then, but it just doesn't seem that way anymore.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's, well, and, you know, so a lot of what we currently do, like a lot of our current cases for Farm to Consumer, a lot involve right to farm and local townships and cities and counties who are infringing, you know, as you get this urban sprawl.
Right.
Where, you know, people don't want to live in the cities anymore, so they want to live in the countryside. They just want the countryside not to be the countryside.
Right.
They don't want chickens and cows and other animals. So they move out into these areas. They gain control of county boards. And then they begin to, people who are trying to be self-sufficient or who are farming, they begin to try and use the county governmental apparatus to deny these people the use of their land and property.
Yes.
So we have lots of cases involving right to farm, zoning, other things. You know, lots of cases involving backyard chickens and other stuff. You know, one of the big cases we recently litigated and were involved with is the Mark Baker case in Michigan, where the Michigan DNR basically is trying to make it illegal to raise any pastured pigs in the entire state.
It's beyond ludicrous.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the new things that we've just noticed that there's been a real uptick in over the past 6 months to a year is the use of animal welfare phone calls and reports to harm small farmers.
Interesting.
So there's the Rockwood case in New York that garnered a whole lot of attention a few months ago. There's a farmer in New York who had a large number of his animals seized. And we came to find out in looking at that case, if I'm remembering the facts correctly, that basically it was an activist animal shelter who reported this farmer, and who they were the ones who then got a hold of the animals and were billing the farmer for caring for his own animals after reporting him to the authorities.
Wow.
For what is not, you know, like, and you do, you have all these animal rights activists, you have these other people who know nothing about farming. Because, like, if you were to come to my farm right now and see my chickens, there's no food out for my chickens. Because we feed the chickens in the morning, and then they have foraging they get to do for the rest of the day.
Right, absolutely.
You know, like, you know, my farm is not a chicken China buffet.
Right.
Like, and so you have these animal welfare groups, which are really, more generally, they're animal activist groups under the guise of animal welfare. Because if they cared about animal welfare, they'd be protesting the CAFOs and other things.
Right.
Not the small pastured farmers.
Right.
You have these animal activist groups, and then the people who are just ill-informed about what it actually looks like to raise animals naturally. Kind of working together and doing great harm to farmers in a number of different states at the moment. You know, there's another farm, I believe it's in Oregon, but it might be in Washington State, where there's an area where they have a special attorney who all he does is animal abuse and welfare issues. Guess who pays his salary?
I don't know.
So he's supposed to be, he works for the government. He's like a public attorney or whatever. But his salary is paid for by an animal welfare council.
Wow. Okay.
Now, you talk about a conflict of interest.
Yeah, big time.
You know, it's just like, I'm just like, so there's more and more of those cases coming up that matter for our members, where you could be doing everything right, and because we get a 0-degree temperature stretch and your water's frozen, and the inspector comes in the afternoon because the water freezes on a 0-degree day in a few hours, and he says you're neglecting and abusing your animals because they don't have water. When you and I both know animals, like people, do not need to drink every 7 minutes.
Right.
Like, my cows get water usually twice a day unless it's a real hot day. And they're designed that way. Like, you know, when chickens and cows were wandering before they had human overlords, they would wander long distances without water and do okay.
Right.
So there's always new issues. You know, the people who are against self-sufficiency and small farming are always trying to find new avenues of attack and depress their agenda.
Absolutely. And I find a lot of times it's in the case, you know, of the animal activists, it's they worship and serve the creation rather than the creator.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah, it's very hard. Because some of them, you know, some of them are vegans or vegetarians. I have no problem with you being a vegan or vegetarian.
Right.
So, I don't think it works dietarily and otherwise. And I don't think it works fertilization wise, you know. The good fertile soil we have is the end result of animals.
Absolutely.
The complex interplay of animals, grasses, predators, and you know, cleanup crew.
That's right.
So I don't care, but, like, please don't, in your view of things, deny me and others our right to raise food naturally and sensibly. It's just crazy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot more we can talk about.
Absolutely.
You know, I want to hit just a few more questions before we need to finish up. You know, you asked how can people be involved. Farm to Consumer is a membership organization. You can be a consumer member. If you're just somebody listening, you don't have a farm, you don't even have a homestead, we have lots of members who are just consumers because they support our mission and our vision and the direction we're going, you know, to secure food freedom and freedom of food choice for people. We also accept donations. We have tons of people who donate money to us and the work we do. We have an event coming up in August at Joel Salatin's farm in Virginia. It's a multi-day event at his farm. If you go to our website, you can look up the Food Freedom Festival, and you can buy tickets to that event. It's a great weekend. We love meeting people in person. Or you can just share the word about that event to help other people know it's happening, because we'd love to just have a gaggle of people who are excited about securing food freedom for themselves and their children. You know, those are all good ways to be involved and help us with what we're doing. Because by being a member, we're able to alert you to what's happening in your state in terms of legislatively or in terms of bureaucratically what's going on and what you can help do to stop it.
Excellent. That's awesome. And this Food Freedom event, yeah, it looks great. Looks really awesome. I'd love to go. Unfortunately, I cannot, but...
Yeah, you're a long way
in
Idaho. Yes. But it's actually Pam Holloway is one of our members, and she's from Idaho. She's going to be making the trek.
Awesome. That's cool.
So, yes, we even have a few people coming all the way from Australia.
Ah, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, so anything people can do to, you know, share with others about our mission, share with others about our work, and, you know, become a member, and if you're able to donate as well. Right now we're doing our annual appeal. There's some really neat gifts you can get for donating.
Very cool.
The Nourishing Homestead book by Ben Hewitt and his wife, which is just a great book for people who are into homesteading.
That is a wonderful book. It's the last book that I read on this, you know, general topic. I really enjoyed it. It was great. They can join Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, whether they're just a consumer or if they're starting a small farm. And there you even have this new homestead category, small farm and homestead category, which is really cool. What else can people do?
Again, in terms of locally, like, you can grow food and buy food from real farmers.
Excellent.
You know,
yep.
In the sense of, like, and you can become active in states that, and just educate people about why being able to choose what you eat and feed your family matters, so that they're better aware. And again, like, you know, you can hold, if you want to do something great locally to educate people who may not understand what's happening, you know, get a copy of Farmageddon and invite a bunch of friends over for a movie night and have a small farmer supply the food you all eat.
That'd be great. That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, and help people connect the dots as to what's happening and why. Because it's a great way to help people opt out of the system.
Yeah, and, you know, that is a key, right? We need to opt out, but we have to have alternatives so that we create alternatives. And we need to opt out of the system for many reasons, many of which you stated here today. That was great, John. I know you got to go. We didn't get to everything. I'd love to have you on again to specifically talk about starting a buying club and kind of, you know, how to do that. I think, you know, whether it's a co-op or CSA, or, you know, you could probably give us a lot of information on how to go about that. And maybe we can have you on someday and maybe use the case study of Maine. That would be great.
Yeah, well, I would love to be back on, so I just hope you have a wonderful night. I'm going to go do a little farming myself for a few minutes and then eat some dinner from our own cabbage and other vegetables.
Awesome, and us too. I've got some, we fermented our own cabbage and made sauerkraut, and we've got some other, I think we're actually having rabbit tonight, and It's going to be good. So thanks again, John. I really appreciate your time.
Great. Have a wonderful day, friend.
All right. You too.
This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We would appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.